This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with humorist Joe Queenan, and we'll be talking about his most recent book, which is titled Balsamic Dreams, A Short But Self-Important History of the Baby Boomer Generation. He's the author of 6 previous books. He's a contributing editor at GQ magazine. He also writes column Good Fences for the New York Times. He's been out and around talking about the book. You might have heard him talking with Michael Feldman this past weekend on the program What Do You Know? Also, I'd like to mention that for people who might be listening up and around the Chicago area, he will be in Winnetka next week, Thursday, June 21st at Bookstall at 811 Elm Street at 7:30. So if you're interested in meeting him, you can do that. And of course, the book is out. It's available in bookstore, published by Henry Holt. As we talk, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Mr. Queenan, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
If I had known that underwriter was coming up, I might have just said, let's put it on another day.
Balsamic vinegar.
It was totally accidental.
Fantastic. So.
I hope, by the way, you know, I don't know if you know anything about Winnetka, but I know you're going deep into enemy territory there.
Why is that?
Next week, because if you're that's the capital
of the world.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Well, I sort of live in that place anyway, because I live in Tarrytown, I live in Tarrytown, which is up the Hudson from New York. It's where, the Headless Horseman took place. And the town that adjoins it is called North Tarrytown. North Tarrytown used to have a gigantic GM plant, which closed about 7 years ago. And all the people, basically baby boomers, who bought houses in North Tarrytown held a plebiscite to rename the town Sleepy Hollow because they thought that it would raise house prices. So I know whereof I speak.
In the book, you write, baby boomers are the most obnoxious people in the history of the human race.
Yes.
That's a pretty strong statement considering all of recorded history.
It is. But, I mean, I stress the fact that they were obnoxious as opposed to, sort of ravenously destructive like the Mongols. I mean, obviously, there are many, many, many generations that have wreaked havoc on society, of which Bertrand Russell said the Mongols were the only society that didn't produce anything worthwhile. But he wouldn't be allowed to say that anymore. But what I was focusing on was more the high annoyingness factor. Because the greatest generation, as Brokaw named them, which of course I grew up hating. I mean, I hated my parents, particularly my dad. That generation had a lot of rough edges to them. They had a bad record on civil rights and things like that. And they drank too much and they smoked and they were nasty, but they weren't annoying in the way that baby boomers are. I mean, baby boomers just can really get up everybody's noses.
And you this is, after all, you're accepting some responsibility as a member of this generation. This is in a sense, in part, self-examination.
So. It is. And some of the things of which I accuse other baby boomers, I'm guilty of myself. For example, when I about 7 or 8 months ago, I guess it was, when I had this cold and thought that I might have, leukemia or cervical cancer or something like that, I decided, my immediate reaction was, look at all the things I haven't done. I haven't made a safari, and I haven't gone to the North Pole, and I haven't been up to Kathmandu or climbed up Everest or learned Portuguese or learned how to fly an airplane. And that's typical of baby boomers. Baby boomers, when confronted by their own mortality, always think, well, it's time to sign up for more self-improvement classes, and never, sort of look at the wider issues. It's not a very philosophical generation, although, in their defense, Americans basically aren't philosophical people, not introspective at all.
Shirley
MacLaine being the obvious exception.
I suppose the most common explanation is it has something to do with the post-war prosperity into which we all were born, and our parents who had known about the Depression, and we were coming into this period where America was on top of the world and we had everything we wanted, and they were determined to give us everything they never had, and it was just all too easy.
That's true up to a point. I grew up in a housing project. So whenever I hear those things about how great things were in the 50s, I always agree that they were generally great, but they certainly weren't great in my neighborhood. There are lots of poor people in the United States, and there were lots of poor people then. That said, it was still easy, even if you were growing up poor in a place like Philadelphia, to lead that kind of countercultural lifestyle in the 60s because, you know, you could rent a room for $8 a week. And it never seemed that anybody, I can never recall anybody actually paying for the drugs in the 60s. It was always some guy named Shelby who just always had a lot. So there was, it was our parents' prosperity, the Eisenhower era, you know, Bob Seger's song, We Were Making Thunderbirds, that era subsidized the sort of impudence and arrogance and rebellion that came to be associated with the baby boomers, which all came apart with the Arab oil embargo. As soon as the financial straitjacket hit, everybody just sort of got rid of those Fu Manchus and peasants' dresses and just went to work for Morgan Stanley. It was the most amazing overnight transformation in history.
Well, that's, the, I guess, one of the things that people will point to, and they'd say that here was a generation of people that, when they were younger, were so committed to being different from their parents, living according to a different set of values. They were out to change the world, and that somehow that didn't last very long, and you know, now they're complaining because it costs so much money to fill up the tanks of their Lincoln Navigators.
Or to send their kids to college or private school. I mean, when we were growing up in the 60s, we were supposed to believe that private schools were going to fade away, and we all believed that private schools were for bad people, that is, Republicans. And then all of a sudden, you grow up and you find out that although baby boomers have a pretty good record on race, they have a pretty bad record on class. So baby boomers now say, I'm not going to send my kids to public school, not because I hate black people or Hispanics, but because I hate, you know, what those white trash kids with those like little rat's tail, you know, ponytails in the back. And there's an awful lot of that. There's an awful lot of classism among baby boomers. One of the things that there were two or three things that I wanted to stress in my book, and one of them was how long ago the baby boomers threw in the towel, because I don't feel that it was like that people progressively aged. I think it was over in the early 70s. I mean, I think just as our parents' generation after the Second World War, they pretty much said, look, we've done our job. We got rid of the Nazis. We got rid of the rising sun. We got rid of Tojo. We survived the Great Depression. That's pretty much it for life. Emotionally, I think the greatest generation just detached themselves from everything and just sort of went to Florida and, you know, did a lot of gambling and things like that, but just sort of opted out. And said, but they did that when they were in their 30s. Baby boomers did it when they were in their 20s. Baby boomers in the early 70s, as the civil rights movement became separated from the anti-war movement, as the Arab oil embargo came in, as a kind of general mellowness came in, I think the baby boomers just took very, very early retirement and emotionally have just been sort of out of it for 30 years.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580, Joe Queenan, his new book is Balsamic Dreams, A Short but Self-Important History of the Baby Boomer Generation. He's the author of 6 previous books. He writes for GQ and the New York Times, and the book is in bookstores now, Henry Holt, the publisher. Your questions and comments certainly are welcome. You want to join in the conversation, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I wonder how much of this maybe has something to do, even though maybe this is a bit more recent phenomenon, but with this sort of feeling that, you know, particularly this happened when we came to the point where we said that the Cold War was over. People were going around talking about the end of history, you know, as if there was nothing, as if it was, the story of civilization was over.
That
anybody who came along there, well, there wasn't anything big for them to do. There was no great contribution for them to make except maybe invent the Palm Pilot. So they're really, I wonder if there isn't this sense out there that, well, you might as well just concentrate on, you know, having the best kitchen and bathroom in town, because what else is there?
Yeah, I think that that's true. I think that there is generally a sense. I think Joe Strummer from The Clash once said that if you grew up in the 70s instead of the 60s and you were in a rock band, you always felt like the sort of reserves who get to Waterloo at 8 o'clock at night and everybody's already dead. And I think that that's a good analogy, that the 60s, because so much stuff did happen, there is a sense that it cast this very long shadow and that it's going to be hard to shake that off. But what I think is interesting is that the baby boomers, when I was growing up, I really hated hearing my dad just talk about the big bands. And it was like, oh, your music's no good. You know, you should listen to Benny Goodman. You should listen to Duke Ellington. You should listen to Lawrence Welk. And they just went on and on about how our music was no good. And Baby Boomers do exactly the same thing. I mean, Baby Boomers actually think that Eric Clapton today is that the music that he makes today, or that Dylan's appalling records are of a quality that they were 30 years ago. And at the same time, they'll look at music that young kids are listening to, and they'll say, oh, it's so horrible. And I listen to some of the music. You know, you listen to people like Beck, or you listen to people like Moby. I think they're great. I think that every generation just produces great pop music. Not every generation produces the Beatles, but not every we produced the Beatles, but we produced a lot of Jerry and the Pacemakers, mm-hmm. and Paul Revere and the Raiders, and a lot of just sort of dumb pop bands, which are exactly like NSYNC and Britney Spears. It's the same thing.
Yeah, actually,
we look down our noses at Gen Xers, and we look down our noses at the kids today.
I think that's very open-minded of you, and in fact, I think what it suggests is the person who says something like that, to me, I think this is a person that actually likes music, that they can find in new music that they might not be familiar with, they can find something. Also, in spite of the fact that it seems like that it's the sworn duty of every generation to find some way to offend and turn off and freak out their elders.
You know, that's a good point, because one of the things that you always find when you hang out with musicians is musicians, by and large, do not distinguish between genres of music. They only distinguish between good music and bad music. So if you sat down with, like, the world's greatest pianist, Maurizio Pollini, say, or you know, somebody of that ilk, they would probably surprise you with some of the music that they like to listen to. I remember hearing that Axl Rose liked to listen, that his role model as a singer was Bing Crosby, because musicians just like music and just listen to music. A friend of mine did an interview with this bass player who was on the Rolling Stones last tour, and he said that, my friend said, well, what are they like? And he said, you know, Mick comes in and out. He's really basically interested in, you know, the money and the fame. But he said that Keith and Ronnie Wood and Charlie Watts and those guys, all they do all day long is talk about music, and they buy records and they listen to new music, because when you stop listening to new music, then you start dying in a way. You just start shriveling up.
Yeah, Charlie, wasn't it Charlie Watts who a few years ago actually put out a record of a big band? He put together a big band?
Yeah. And which I think is interesting, because I don't actually like Charlie Watts' drumming that much. I mean, I mean he's a great rock drummer, but it's not he's a heavy-footed drummer. He couldn't be a jazz drummer, a really good jazz drummer. But I don't care if people do things that don't work. Like, even with Woody Allen, as much fun as people have making fun of his serious movies, I still admire the impulse to do that, because everybody wants to stretch, even if they make fools of themselves. Michael Jordan wanted to be a baseball player. He made a fool of himself, and then he went back to what he did good. Woody Allen, when he tries to make serious movies, they're terrible. But still, they're trying to do something. They're not just sticking with the same thing over and over and over again.
Yeah. This, you know, the intent of the book obviously is to be humorous. Did you also, in your heart of hearts, actually want to make a statement?
Yeah.
Even though that in the book you go on about people making statements, and that's maybe one of the problem with this generation. We too much want to make statements.
Yeah, but you know, one of the things about satire is that people think you're not serious about it, but you're deadly serious about it. I mean, the people that I admire are, you know, Jonathan Swift and Molière and Aristophanes and people like that, Mark Twain. They were deadly serious about what they were writing. I mean, they just use humor as a way of making broad statements. And a lot of times you say outrageous things. Like, for example, I say that the single worst thing that ever happened to the Baby Boomers was the release of Carole King's Tapestry. That happens to be a personal opinion, and I really do believe that. I thought when Tapestry came out, uh-oh, that's it, it's over. Now we'll be mellow forever. And, you know, Helen Reddy came afterwards, and ABBA came afterwards, and you know, all those Anne Murrays and all those people came afterwards. But I really do personally feel that the whole generation fell apart when Carole King's Tapestry was released. Now, I am aware that that is an outrageously stupid thing to say. But, you know, the whole point is, let's just get the conversation going here. Let's just get the pot boiling. Let's just see what happens here. And I know that there are certain buttons that you push like that you can get things going. I mean, I've always found if you're in a room full of basically wishy-washy liberals, which basically describes everybody that I know, If you're in a room and you say something bad about Jimmy Carter, people get really, really upset because they have that whole thing about habitat and, you know, what he did this and he tried to win the Nobel Peace Prize and he was doing this. He was just a terrible president. He was just a terrible, terrible, terrible president. He was wrecking this country, and I don't like the guy. And I constantly bring up his names just because I know it's going to annoy people.
Whoa.
It annoys people because, you know when you were talking about the Berlin Wall coming down?
Mm.
The Berlin Wall coming down, as opposed to VJ Day, as opposed to victory in Europe, was not something that everybody in America could celebrate jubilantly because nobody wanted to admit that Ronald Reagan was partially responsible for that. It was not a united front. Also, there's a lot of people in the United States, I think, who are sorry to see it come down. I think the people of the nation were like kind of disappointed that, you know, the Berlin Wall finally came down.
We got a caller to bring into the conversation. Others are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Aurora, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi. As the mother of 3 baby boomers, I consider myself having gone through it all and survived. I guess I'm a survivor. And one of the things that I remember from the 60s is one Sunday afternoon, my husband and I were calmly sitting in the living room, and a car came into the driveway. And my husband very loudly, and he was a very quiet man, but he very loudly said, "They did it. They did it." And I said, "What? What happened?" All I heard was a car coming in the driveway. What did they do? Well, my daughter had bought a foreign car, and that was very taboo at that time. You didn't buy foreign cars. Now, of course, everybody accepts it. You know, buying a foreign car is where it's at. And so that, in the 60s, was a very big thing as far as I was concerned, and, of course, the hair. But the thing that's very interesting to me as a grandmother now of grandchildren from children of the 60s is their expectations are of their children are almost higher than mine were of them. Do you have any comments?
Yeah, I think that that's generally true. I think that one of the things about baby boomers and their children that's a problem is baby boomers can't get it through their kids, their heads, that your kids are not your science project. And your kids are not necessarily going to fulfill your dreams any more than we fulfilled our parents' dreams. When I took up the guitar, my dad just like freaked out completely. My dad wouldn't even say the word guitar. He used the word banjo because he was so dismissive. He wanted me to learn to play the piano or learn to play the trumpet like, you know, Harry James. And I could not fulfill the dreams that my father had for me because I wanted to have my own life. And it's going to be the same with our kids. You know, this whole thing about sort of, you know, you give them the Heisenberg Uncertainty Principle flashcards when they're 4 years old and you make them listen to Mozart when they're 6. Some of them are still going to grow up to be Ted Bundy. There's nothing you can do about it. It's, you know, every man for himself. And
well,
baby boomers are having a really hard time dealing with that.
The only thing I can say is my children have far surpassed my expectations. They have done wonderfully. And I guess I did a lot of praying.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you much.
All
bye-bye.
Right, thanks for the call. We're getting here close to the midpoint of this hour of Focus 580. We're talking with Joe Queenan. We don't need to take just a second here to do a little public radio business, Joe, if you'll forgive us.
Okay.
And we'll get back to you in just a second. We'll just take a minute here because we would like to remind people who are listening that here at WILL, we are coming to the end of our fiscal year that ends at the 30th of June. And the reason that that's important is that the money that we'll spend on programming and running things next year, we need to have that money in the bank by June 30th. So we're now working on doing a little last minute fundraising. And our station manager, Dan Simeone, is here just to talk for a second about kind of where we are and why it is important that if people have been thinking about it, now would be a good time to take it beyond just thinking about it and actually make a contribution if they can.
That's right. And we do hope that you will consider making a contribution soon. I just talked to Rita Schulte, our membership director, to get an update on where we're at in terms of our goal. And we still have about $107,000 to go to reach our goal of $700,000 by June 30th. So it's going to take a real good push here in the last couple weeks, last few weeks of our fiscal year. And as David said, we start getting bills for the programs next fiscal year, shortly after June 30th. So 40% of the money we use to pay those bills now comes directly from listeners. So you're very, very important to the station. So I hope you'll consider making a contribution as soon as possible. There are a number of ways to do that. If you'd like to contribute right now, you can call 217-333-0850. And we'll be glad to take your contribution by phone. You can mail a check to the Friends of WILL Radio, 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. Or if you're using your computer, you can contribute by credit card online on our website, our secure site at will.uiuc.edu. And we hope to hear from you soon. Thank you to everyone that's already contributed this year. We appreciate your support very much.
Okay, thanks, Dan. This is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name's David Inge, and the guest this morning, Joe Queenan. He writes for GQ. He's contributing editor at GQ Magazine. He writes a column, Good Fences, for the New York Times. He's the author of 7 books, and the newest we're talking about here this morning is titled Balsamic Dreams, a Short but Self-Important History of the Baby Boomer Generation. Henry Holt is the publisher. It's in the bookstore if you want to look at it. And if you want to call in, you have questions, comments, you want to share your own thoughts, you can do that. In Champaign, Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Here's another caller to bring in, and Champaign. Line 1. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I'm a Champaign caller, and I was born in the 70s. And I sometimes feel, when I talk to the people who were born during the 60s, that nothing really has been accomplished since then in a lot of areas, like in the area of civil rights. They feel like they started it all. I mean, there was lots of things going on before they were around. I also want to comment on the fact that they are the softest generation in terms of, kids growing up in the 40s and 50s, I think, had to be a little bit tougher. The whole culture was not centered around their amusement. Like, if you look at TV in the 60s, you should scarcely turn on a TV without finding a show for kids. And the culture seemed to change with them. Like, as they got older, the stuff that was being marketed toward them. And now we get into their not twilight years, but as, again, they get into a one more generation older, like, the whole culture is again going to change. We're going to turn into a more, like, older person-centered culture because they're this bulge in our population that's going to need health care and, I don't know, spiritual guidance and et cetera, et cetera.
Well, Joe, you have some thought about that?
I think that, first of all, one of the things that that happened in the 60s that baby boomers take credit for is driving Lyndon Baines Johnson from office, which we did. But Lyndon Baines Johnson is the man who got the Civil Rights Bill pushed through. And there's in a certain way, all baby boomers have to feel have completely mixed feelings about what happened then, because Lyndon Johnson stands taller than many other presidents, including JFK, because of what he did, particularly being a Southerner, pushing the Civil Rights Bill through. All that said, part of what I talk about in my book is that baby boomers like to take credit for things that other baby boomers did. Like, when you talk about the Civil Rights Movement, talk about the, you know, the Freedom Riders. Well, I wasn't a Freedom Rider, you know. Those 3 kids who got killed down in Mississippi, they're the ones who are responsible for things. Ellsberg's the guy who leaked the Pentagon Papers. Baby boomers have a real strong, they're always talking about, well, I was scarred by JFK's death, I was scarred by RFK's death, I was scarred by Martin Luther King's assassination. Well, imagine how Martin Luther King was scarred by his assassination. I mean, baby boomers always act like all that stuff had this permanent effect on them. However, all that said, there are things that every generation is responsible for in some way, and there's no doubt whatsoever that baby boomers on civil rights had a much, much better record than their parents or any preceding generation. Feminism is an outgrowth of that generation. But the problem with baby boomers is they seem to have decided fairly early, okay, that's enough. We don't hate minorities anymore. Well, we've stopped the lynchings in the South. The war's over. That's it. We're not going to do anything more for the rest of our lives except be nostalgic. And I'm not joking. When I named the book Balsamic Vinegar, I'm not joking about how much energy baby boomers transferred from sort of moral crusades of their youth to food. I mean, baby boomers' greatest contribution probably is nobody ever worked better with puff pastry than baby boomers. No generation in the history of the world makes better risottos than baby boomers. But it is amazing how obsessive baby boomers are about food, clothing, recreation, vehicles, travel, and status.
Can they be described as the disposable income generation?
Excuse me?
Can they be described as the disposable income generation? Like,
yeah, I think
they had more disposable income than any other generation that was before them and thus had more leisure time to spend on more nonsense?
Yeah, I think that that's a fair thing to say. I everybody has mixed feelings about when, you know, the whole thing about life begins at 40 or life begins at 50 or life begins at 60. I think it's really good if people, when they turn 50, take up some kind of hobby, like, let's say, learning a foreign language, learn Italian or, you know, something like that. But baby boomers take up 10 hobbies. They all have to learn to fly helicopters, you know. You hear these, read these stories in the newspaper about how they're not, now they're going to be skydiving at age 60. It's like, when are you going to grow up? And when are you going to get off the stage and let somebody else have a chance?
That's an interesting point. You know, every time the Rolling Stones make another album that sells however many million copies, they're forcing somebody else, like only a certain number of records get sold. It may be a very large number. But every time they come out with another something, they're keeping the younger bands down. Like, they're keeping the attention away from, I mean, MTV's going to play their video. They're the Rolling Stones. Greatest rock band of all time.
I don't see anything wrong with playing the Rolling Stones videos, but I see something wrong with playing so many of those old videos. I mean, there's always going to be a market for, you know, Duke Ellington was selling records when he was in his 70s, and nobody complained about that because Duke Ellington or Mick Jagger would turn around and say, well, I'm a musician. This is what I do for a living. If you don't like it, don't buy the records. However, something that is sort of appalling, has appalling effect on the generation, is when Bob Dylan turned 50 10 years ago, the New York Times asked me to write a story about him, and I did. I wrote this big story and basically said, you know, after Blood on the Tracks, that was pretty much it. He ran out of gas. He made a lot of really bad records. Every record had a couple of good songs, but that was basically it. It was over. They wouldn't publish the story, so it ended up running in Spy. Now he turns 60, and there was this amazing outburst of affection, which is great. I mean, everybody, you know, from my generation loves Bob Dylan. But I listen to those records, and I think, how is this any different from when I was a little kid and Vic Damone was putting out a new record? I mean, it's over. It's been over for 30 years. Why do we think it's different when our aging musicians put out the same record over and over and over again, and yet when our parents had, like, Mel Torme or Eddie Fisher doing that, we made fun of them? And that's the thing that's very interesting, is that baby boomers said that they would not do what their parents did, and they did it in spades.
I'm going to jump in here. I appreciate the comments of the call, and I have a couple of other people I want to get on to. I just want to sort of follow up on one thing, because on the one hand, we do talk about the fact that the percentage of the population that's seniors, we got this big, this big demographic thing that's happening, and we keep talking about all the dramatic changes that we're going to see as a result of the fact that we're going to have so many people in the older age cohorts. At the same time, one of the things that you observe, and I think rightly so, is that this is a population that is not interested seemingly in aging gracefully. They're not interested in aging at all. That we're really continuing to be obsessed with being young, or at least trying to act like we're young. How do those? It seems to me here we have two trends that just slam right into each other.
I think here's something that I don't understand. Okay, no matter what is going on in your mind, your body is telling you that you're old. Your vision fails when you're about 40. You have to get reading glasses,
every time you get an injury playing basketball or tennis or bicycling when you're like 45, it takes 6 months to recover instead. So why can't people accept the fact that growing old is part of life? Growing old just as much, you know, the line from C.S. Lewis, the happiness then was part of the pain, now that's the deal. Or vice versa. You were young, you're no longer young. Try to be a role model for younger people. When I see like a 55-year-old guy with an earring on rollerblades and a baseball cap turned backwards, just figure out that that's what Aristophanes wrote about 400 years before Christ, old men who won't grow up. Just stop. And we used to think that it was always like, you know, old guys in Hollywood, cigar-smoking impresarios and producers who were 70 years old and who had 20-year-old women. We're going to end up doing the same thing. You know, we're going to be like 75 years old, and we're going to be like the 14th reunion of Cream. I mean, what's wrong with going to see a new band? You know, what's wrong with, like if you were living in the 19th century, suppose you were a big fan of Beethoven. Okay, Beethoven dies, and when you're old, here comes Wagner. Well, why not go to hear Wagner? Is everything always going to be just connected with your youth? Isn't it possible to imagine things happening today that, and people today doing things, young people doing things that could give you pleasure? I don't know. I find that that sclerotic effect of growing old and saying, on the one hand, I'm going to do things like skydiving, or I'm going to, you know, climb Mount Everest, but at the same time being unreceptive to new experiences, to new cultural experiences. I just think a sort of sclerosis sets in, and that's when people start dying.
Let's talk with somebody else. Champagne, line two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I had a couple of comments, and I guess what I would like to do is maybe introduce some nuance into this conversation, because so far we're setting it up real black and white, either or. And maybe my perspective comes from the fact that I've never figured out where I fit in, because technically I guess I'm at the very, very tail end of the baby boom.
And when were you born?
1962.
Probably, so, I think 60's the cutoff.
Yeah, Kennedy, well, I often see it go all the way up to 64.
Yeah, but I think it's 43 to 60.
Okay,
it's basically the classic baby boomer is 48 to 55, and then everybody is a tail ender, but You were like one when Kennedy died.
Right.
You were six when the Tet Offensive took place.
They don't mean anything.
You were a little bit. I think you're more in that generation between. You're in the ABBA generation between baby boomers and Gen X.
Well, that's what I was going to say.
And I feel sorry for you, because that generation is there. That's like the Johnny Mathis generation of the 50s. The people between the greatest generation and the baby boomers. That generation that grew up in the 50s is kind of a small generation and kind of a lost generation.
That's exactly what I wanted to say. There's a lot of us out there who are not the stereotypical baby boomers. And, you know, I don't drive an SUV. I have no interest in doing it. I'm not into the whole consumption thing. But by the same token, there's a lot of things about sort of Gen X people that frankly appall me. So I don't think I necessarily fit in either one. But what I really wanted to say was, and I guess this is in a way a comment directly to the previous caller, is if you're my age, what happened to us is that when we were growing up, all television, all movies, all advertisements were aimed at adults. So it was like, okay, I can't wait to grow up because then I can have that. I can't wait. So now I'm a grown-up, and all movies, all television shows and all advertising is aimed at young people, you know, that demographic male 18 to 24 or whatever. And so I feel like I went through life and nothing was actually for me. Have you ever heard people make
yes.
that comment before?
Yeah, people who were born like 62, 63, 64 always say that.
Yeah.
That they find themselves trapped between these generations because temperamentally people born in that period don't have the sort of Gen X, I'm trying to think of the polite word, but I guess the
aggression?
Word. What? I was going to say lethargy.
Yeah.
It's not a sort of dismal mood, but it's just a kind of
there's a kind of shoulder slumping in that generation. And part of it is just because they feel oppressed by the baby boomers. They feel that they just sort of had to find their way into this world. And it's become a cliche to describe them as slackers, but there is a kind of general feeling that there's a sort of, you know, shoulder shrugging about things. I mean, the classic term that Gen Xers use is whatever.
Right, right.
Whatever doesn't really describe anything.
So age is part of it, but then I would also say gender is part of it too, because you know, there really are these distinctions for men and women. Like, for example, I can't tell you the number of times that I have heard young women who are receiving college educations and planning to go to law school or medical school will say, oh, I'm not a feminist, and they're very anti-feminist, and they never get it. They never get the joke that the reason they can do these things is there was a generation before them, you know, who blazed the trail. So while we're blaming baby boomers for a lot of things, I think for women, women owe a great deal of debt, I think, to that generation. And the other thing I wanted to say is, when you were talking about aging and why can't you act your age, again, for women, I think the consequences of entering middle age in our culture are a lot more drastic than they are for men.
I think that that's true. But I think that the thing is that for women it's harder because of the values that the society has, and it's like, oh, now you've got, you know, gray hair, you've got to cut your hair, you've got to have a page boy, so everybody's got to dress like that.
Or just go away because we really don't want to look at you anymore.
Right, exactly. But the thing is that women, I think, of that age group are less likely to do the spectacularly ridiculous things that men do. Like, I think one of the most ridiculous middle-aged things is the middle-aged pot-bellied rock band.
Oh, you know, I agree.
You hear all these guys getting together,
makeup,
and it's like, oh, come on, couldn't you do some community service or something? Or couldn't you like clean the highway or like?
I'll agree with you there. Yeah.
That was great. Everybody was in a band when they were a kid, and it was fun. But grow up, and you weren't any good anyway.
Yeah. Right. Right. Okay. Well, that was just my way of adding some, you know, twists and bends in the conversation.
I appreciate the comments. We got somebody here on a cell phone. We'll get to them on line one. Hello?
Yeah, I'd like to second what the previous caller said and say kudos to her for calling my generation, Generation X, a bunch of slackers, because it seems that generally most of them are kind of waiting for people to hand them things, as, you know, the cliche is what happened with the baby boomers. But the real life is, you know, nobody's going to hand it to you, and I'd like to, you know, just kind of prop her up for saying that. And I'd also like to ask the conversationalist here a question about, you know, a story that I read in his magazine, GQ, about how the baby boomer generation has taken their children and turned them into, you know, sort of the soccer-playing generation or whatever, and how soccer has turned from a very unruly game in Europe into a very, very bland and sort of, you know, self-promoting game here in America, and what his, you know, take is on that.
When my children were small, I swore that I would disown them if they ever played soccer. And my daughter played it for about 4 years, and she was terrible at it. She's an okay volleyball player, but she was terrible at soccer because she doesn't have any speed and she's not mean. And my son was so affected by this that he didn't play soccer till about 2 years ago. But he was secretly playing it at school. But he wasn't part of that ASO organization. He would secretly play at lunch, and people would come up to me and say, they'd say, your son's a really good soccer player. So one day I said to him, well, why don't you join the soccer team? He says, well, I know you hate soccer. I said, well, go ahead and join the soccer team. He's a fantastic soccer player, and I went out and watched them play, and for the first time realized that a lot of the boys would rather play soccer, first of all, because on his team there's a lot of kids from the Dominican Republic, there's a lot of kids from Peru, there's kids from Colombia. So, you know, there's more of a mix of kids there. But also, a lot of kids growing up now hate playing baseball because it's so boring. And they hate playing football because it's just fat guys running into each other. If soccer is played well, it's a great sport. And I'll tell you something, once those kids get to be 14, they get pretty nasty. I mean, I watched two games over the weekend, and they are kicking, they are tripping, they have the elbows in the face. It is certainly not as rough and demonic as it is in South America or in Europe, but it's a pretty rough sport. And I think it's great that anything that you can do to get kids to run around is great. I hated playing baseball when I was a kid. I hated it, just standing around waiting for something to happen. So
I understand, and I think it's great that people can enjoy soccer, but I was, you know, kind of asking about the sentimentality that it's every parent's responsibility to enroll their child in soccer, and that, you know, soccer is this great thing to boost their ego and other alternative sports outside of baseball and, you know, football are getting misled, like the running sports, cross country, and other sports like that that are kind of getting the focus taken away from them because just everyone feels obliged to enroll their children in soccer program.
I think that that's true when they're young, because when kids are young, anybody can play soccer, but by the time they get to be 11 or 12, the kids who stink start dropping out. I mean, there's just tremendous peer pressure on kids once you can't play to just drop off the team. And then the other thing that happens is once they get to be 13 or 14, a lot of the boys do drift away and play other sports. A lot of kids do play baseball because their dads want them to, and a lot of kids go off and play basketball. The advantage of basketball being that you can play with 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 people, whereas with soccer you usually need 10 to make it a good game. Basketball, you can have a great game with just 4 people. My son's just starting to get interested in basketball now.
Okay, well, thanks a lot.
All right, thanks for the call. Bye. Let's go to Champagne Line 3 for another caller. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Let me preface this by saying that I don't read GQ, so I may be misrepresenting it, but it seems to me that that's a magazine that feeds all these things that you're railing against. I mean, it seems to be all about, fashion and nice,
right, you don't
wealthy
read
lifestyle and all that stuff.
Right, you don't read GQ.
Yeah.
So you've made your point, because if you turn to the current issue of GQ, you'll see a 90-page story in there by James Ellroy about Kennedy's assassination. You'll always see some like crime stuff. You see political stuff. You'll see cultural stuff, and then you'll see all the ads for really fancy, great clothes. But the point that you're making is not valid. But as you prefaced it by saying you don't read the magazine, so you know. Maybe we should talk about a magazine that you do read.
Well, I don't know that I'm a huge magazine reader.
You could say
although I would say, I understand that you have to paint things with a broad brush because you're talking about entire generation, and I certainly think there's a lot to in a lot of the criticisms that you're making. But at the same time, the people who are real activists and making things happen in any generation have always been a minority. And even during, what you seem to look at as the heyday of the baby boom generation of the 1960s, it was just a small minority of people who were doing the organizing and a lot of people sort of showed up for some of the events.
Small minority of people who marched on Washington. That was not a ton. There were millions of people. There were millions of people in the anti-war movement. But more to the point, there were millions of people who were involved in an effort at some level to change society in a basic way. Millions of people were involved in feminism. Millions of people were involved in the civil rights movement in just the way people changed their attitudes towards other ethnic groups. If you went to public school, if you sent your kids to public school, all of those things are, you don't have to be an activist to be involved in things in society. You can do it at all kinds of levels. But the one thing that definitely changed after that early period was at a very early point in their lives, baby boomers started becoming nostalgic. And then this kind of frozen quality set in where all of a sudden you don't buy a new record, you don't buy a new book, you don't go to see new movies, and all of a sudden you're just like your parents.
Well, Yeah, I mean, it seems that once again, like this is true of many, many generations. I mean, I was there during the 60s. I was involved in the anti-war movement. I continued to do, you know, things a long time after that. It's still have that sort of involvement that you're talking about. And I, you know, when I was in high school and helping organize moratorium day stuff, it was just you know, it wasn't that many that were involved compared to the, you know, entire population.
There weren't that many people involved in the French Revolution either, but they wouldn't have had a revolution if they didn't have a lot of other people in the streets.
And I'm going to jump in here just because we're just about out of time,
okay.
And I'm my apologies to the caller, and we have some other people we can't take. But I guess I suppose there might be some people who would accuse you of premature old foginess and say that in sort of like the last caller, I don't know if I'm putting words in his mouth, but that people always say this about their, you know, they always say these things about the younger generation. Don't we, that they're always a great disappointment to us? And that they don't know what really matters, and we question their values. And
I think that that's true, but I think that it's what's interesting about it is that there are different generations that stand out that because of historical circumstances. Our parents' generation, the people who lived through the Great Depression, fought through the Second World War, they were in a position to do great things. They did do great things. They rose to the occasion. Other generations didn't have the same opportunity. People always talk about Teddy Roosevelt as the perfect example of a man who never really had the opportunity to be a great president because great and momentous world events were not taking place at the time that he was alive, as opposed to FDR. So I think that while it is true that some, you know, you look down on, you will look at people and say, yes, you know, young people aren't measuring up. What I'm saying in my book is a little bit different in that what I'm saying is, why is it that a generation that on one hand said, we're not going to be like our parents and we're going to be forever young, became like their parents and then became prematurely old?
Hmm. Well, we're going to have to stop. I want to say, Mr. Queenan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We're talking with us, Joe Queenan. He is a contributing editor at GQ. He writes a column for the New York Times, Good Fences. He's authored several books, including the one we were talking about here, Balsamic Dreams. It's out now, published by Henry Holt. And again, I want to mention for people in the Chicago area, if you'd like to hear more from him, have a chance to meet him, he'll be at the bookstall in Winnetka next Thursday, the 21st of June at 7:30. That's at 811 Elm Street. So if you'd like to stop by, you should feel welcome.